welcome to episode 8 of the Rethinking Podcast. My name is Zach Baker, and on today's episode, I'm talking to Rebecca Goldstein. Rebecca is a philosopher, novelist, and the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. On this episode, we talk about a few of her recent books, why philosophy often isn't taught in school, what the axial age is, and much more. Let's get into the show. Professor Goldstein, welcome to the show.
It's very good to meet you.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming. And I just gave a little bit of an introduction, but I'd like to ask you to put it in your own words. Sort of, what do you do when people ask you? What do you do?
Yeah, well, I do think of myself as foremost, I don't want to say philosopher, but, you know, someone who's interested in philosophy, who's taught philosophy, studied philosophy, and who experiments. I think philosophy is so great and so unappreciated and so much not a part of the public conversation that it ought to be a part of. But from the very beginning, when I was an assistant professor, I was convinced, you know, that everybody in some way is thinking about philosophy. I mean, you can't avoid it, really. The difference between a justified and an unjustified belief, justified and an unjustified action. I mean, you know, as fantastic as physics and math and history is, you can get through life without having to decide any of these right. things, but not philosophy. And so, you know, it just seemed my mission somehow to discover ways of writing that would, you know, spread the good word, that would make philosophy really bring it home. And so before I even, you know, before I had tenure, which was stupid, as an assistant professor, I wrote a novel, The Mind-Body Problem, and it either had the great good fortune or bad fortune of selling very well, of being a New York Times bestseller, which made me seem very suspect to my philosophical colleagues. And mind you, this was, when was it, early 80s, and philosophy was not exactly a welcoming place for women. And then I went and I wrote this sexy novel, right? You know, sort of, you know, Mind-Body Problem. It has all sorts of right. things you can, and I exploited them. I don't deny it, but it did deal with what we then call the mind-body problem, now called the hard problem of consciousness. Anyway, so that made my relationship with academic philosophers a little more questionable and sketchy than I had anticipated. Mm-hmm. All I ever wanted to do was just be an academic philosopher who experimented with other ways of writing. So I guess I float in and out of academia. I need philosophers to talk to, right, to bounce ideas off of. But since writing that novel, I've been going on to do other experiments in writing philosophy. I've never been quite part of the community again in the way that I was at, say, 26 right. when I got out of graduate school.
And you think that has something to do with the fact, because you're writing best-selling novels, you're sort of seen as different from sort of what is just a traditional philosopher in the academy?
Yeah, I think things have gotten better now. Yeah, at the time that I did it, it was a crazy thing to do. But I couldn't help it. The novel was simply born in me. You know, I heard the first line. The whole thing just burst forth. And I just sat down and wrote it, not thinking of consequences.
something philosophers are supposed to do. No, I'm so glad you wrote it. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about you as a philosopher is that you don't stay cooped up in just academia, but you bring philosophy out to people who want to read about it. Like me, when I discovered your most recent book, Plato with the Googleplex, which I want to talk to you a little bit about. But why do you think it is that, I mean, as you mentioned, philosophy is a part of all of our lives. It's how we think about the world. It's how we think about what's true and what's not. But then it seems like there's a whole lack of conversation about it. You know, sort of in our interpersonal, you know, at the interpersonal level in our day-to-day life. I mean, you even were, why is that?
Yeah, there both is and isn't. That is, people are always talking. And I mean, this whole science religion debate that I've been rather involved in, you know, what are people talking about if not philosophy, epistemology? What can we know? What are the limits of knowledge? Right. You know, they're talking this stuff. Can there be ethics without God? What are you kidding? I mean, this has been going, we've had this conversation since Euthyphro, you know, since, you know, Plato wrote the Euthyphro. It's old, old, old. There's a great history to it. Philosophers, the whole history of philosophy informs this question, but people talk about it as if they're the first to think about these things. I mean, it amazes me. So they are talking it, but without knowing that a lot of work has been done before. It's as if I were about to step in and say, oh, I'm going to think about the physics of space-time without, you know, first studying Newton and then Einstein. You know, it's like, whoa, what can I figure out here? So it's, you know, to me, it's the same sort of thing that's going on. Somebody, I had just tweeted something. So, you know, I tweet as Plato, so it's
Your Twitter account is awesome.
My handle is Plato on Book Tour. Yeah, because, you know, my publisher, I had never used any social media, and for the last book, my publisher said, you know, you gotta have a presence somehow or other. So fortunately, I did not go onto Facebook, but I thought, well, one of my daughters said, well, what about tweeting as Plato? So it won't be so self-promotional. And yeah, it's kind of fun. but I tweeted something to this effect. And, you know, I got sort of responses, people saying, oh, that's all we need, or, you know, a bunch of intellectuals. I think I said something quite unplatonic, that maybe what we don't need are philosopher kings, but philosopher peasants. That is, that everybody should become, in some sense, informed by philosophy, since they can't avoid it in their lives. And some people wrote back, yeah, that's all we need, or a bunch of more intellectuals, and everybody has to be an intellectual. And of course, that's not the point. You don't have to be a full-time philosopher, but just, you know, just as when you go to high school, you learn how to do geometrical proofs, you know, to know that something of the history here and the methods, you know, the methods of critical reason, but something of the history of these questions and how much progress we'd actually made with some of these questions.
Right. Yeah, I think there's two things I want to dive into there. One is, why do you think that's not something that's more commonly taught in high school and sort of accepted? Why do you think that is?
I guess there aren't really people trained to teach it, okay, even. You know, if you're trained in philosophy, you want to teach at the university level. I don't know why. I mean, I know, you know, there are private schools in which, you know, philosophy is certainly taught, and in some European schools, philosophy is taught. So I teach occasionally at the school, a quite new school in England, in London, called the New College of the Humanities, which was founded by the philosopher Anthony Grayling, and he has, you know, visiting people coming in and teaching. And those students who are very highly educated in secondary school, they come in as freshmen knowing quite a bit of philosophy. They've taken philosophy. So it's just, somehow it's just not part of our tradition here.
Right.
And children are natural philosophers. I mean, I just found, I have two children, and, you know, I just found them explosively philosophical, you know, when they were growing up, before the conventions of thinking had settled in and sort of curbed their thought processes. There, you know, it was like all sorts of possible right. worlds were being juggled around, and you know, and because, and it just, you know, I remember they were both, and I think this has been now substantiated by people like Paul Bloom, experimental psychologist in at Yale, but that they were both sort of natural dualists, right? They were Cartesian dualists. They thought, you know, they were not their bodies. I remember one of my daughters at about 3 years old, she, like her mother, talks with her hands, right? So I also talk with my hands. And we could never get through a meal without her knocking over the grape juice or the milk, you know, because she'd be expressively talking. And then she knocked over grape juice, which was always a disaster. And she goes, "Oh, look at what my body did." And I said, "Oh, you didn't do that?" She said, "No, I didn't do that. My body did that." You know, which I guess she meant, you know, that she associated herself with her intentions. Right. She didn't intentionally do that. But that sort of it's just kind of fascinating. So, of course, man, I just zoomed right in and started talking about the mind-body yeah. problem with this 3.5-year-old. She was totally receptive.
Right. I mean, it does feel like children are sort of naturally asking why in a way, right?
Oh, yeah.
But somehow we sort of like...
They ask why until they get down to that philosophical question. And it's just, we should be prepared to feed that.
I mean,
you
talk about that in your book, this peculiar type of question that emerges, which is the philosophical question, which I loved. I hadn't heard that phrase before, this peculiar type of question. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that. And you also introduced a term that I was unfamiliar with, the axial age, how this kind of emerges in a couple different places around the world at the same time. So I'd love for you to talk a little about that philosophical question, about that time.
Yeah. Well, so, and you know, Plato the Googleplex, I go back... you know, to the ancient Greeks and the big question, which is, why were they so damn smart? You know, when they just, you know, laid out the foundations of, you know, what we call Western civilization, but they discovered philosophy, you know, it's not that they were that they were all philosophers. They were not, you know, philosopher peasants. They, after all, put Socrates to death, right? We have to always remember that they're, but they did give birth to this way of thinking. And Plato in particular, I find really fascinating because he really has a nose for the philosophical question, which arises in just about every area of human concern and human inquiry. So, you know, think how the philosophical landscape is divvied up. You know, for everything, there's the philosophy of that field, philosophy of science, philosophy of physics, philosophy of math, philosophy of religion, philosophy of education, philosophy of language, philosophy of art. I mean, I could just go on and on, right? Philosophy of behavior, which is ethics, political philosophy, philosophy of knowledge itself, right? Epistemology. So for everything that we think of, this peculiar kind of question arises, and he got that, you know, and so he kind of carves out the whole terrain that we've been digging in ever since. So it's not that I think Plato offered all the answers, because, I mean, that would be a poor judgment on philosophical progress if this guy who lived 2,400 years ago gave us all the answers, then what are we doing now? But he did lay out, you know, in all of these different areas, the kind of question that is not an empirical question. Sometimes it is. Sometimes they were, you know, there were these proto-scientific questions that the ancient Greeks asked, the kinds of, and certainly the pre-Socratics, that's the kind of question they asked, which became questions, and sometimes, you know, Plato and Aristotle also ask these questions, but they become the questions of, you know, physics and biology and cosmology. When the empirical methodology catches up, we can actually get answers using the empirical methodology. But then there's this other kind of question that we can make progress with, but it doesn't depend on empirical findings. In some sense, we have all the facts. We're not in need of different facts. We have to arrange the the facts in the right order. We have to see where our inconsistencies lie and try to maximize our coherence. And this is the work of philosophy. But it's this peculiar kind of question that you can ask about these various domains that can't be answered by the domains themselves. Like in philosophy of science, we ask, what is it that science is actually doing? Is it discovering hidden aspects of reality, or is it just a complicated means of making further predictions? You know, does it expand our ontology, or doesn't it? You know, or in mathematics, you know, you could do mathematics, and mathematicians do mathematics. They don't agree on what they're doing when they're doing mathematics, and they don't have to. That's a philosophical question. Are they discovering, you know, eternal necessary truths that exist independent of our discovery of them, or are they just kind of playing a higher order chess, you know, that we make up rules and then we see the consequences? Those are questions that can't be answered by the domains themselves. They're meta questions. And they arise everywhere in everything that we think about. So, and he asked them, Plato asked them.
Right, and the Greeks came up with different answers than a tribe which you call the Irvin, which meant over, which were the Jewish people, who had different sort of answers to similar questions. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that and how those two different ideas shape sort of where we are today.
Well, I can go back to the former question you asked to set the sort of context, which I forgot to answer, which is this axial age, which is not a term that I made up. It was actually a philosopher, Carl Jaspers, who was an existentialist German philosopher, lived through the Holocaust. And I think his wife was Jewish. But in any case, he was the one who noticed that in a certain period of time, roughly 800 to 200 BCE, with a big crest in 600, the 6th century BCE, all of the normative frameworks, the frameworks that tell us how we ought to live, were forged that still exist into our time. They're still extant. And so a whole host of religions that still hold billions of us. So the Abrahamic religion, Confucianism, Taoism in India, I just got back from Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Zoroastrianism in Persia, and probably forgetting some of the religions, and in Europe, in Greece, philosophy and tragic poetry, and that they all emerge, you know, during this same period in far-flung regions of the globe and in city-states that are fairly well organized. And they all address the question that all of us are concerned with, which is, I have a short time online here. Many have come before me. They loved and longed and fought and struggled and won and lost and put all their attention and energy and passion into living their lives, and they're gone. There's not a trace of them left. Do they matter? Do I matter? Why should I think that the same thing won't happen to me? What can I do with these few short years to achieve a sense that I matter, to achieve a life worth living? And all of these normative frameworks offer different answers to questions that interest us enough that these normative frameworks are still alive among us. And what's so interesting about the Greeks is they participate in the Axial Age. He called it the Axial Age because these frameworks come out at us like radios of a bicycle, you know, into our own day. But the Greeks, so interestingly, although they were a society that was highly religious, saturated with religious rituals, they didn't do anything, go on a trip or play their sports or marriages, babies, anything without offering to the gods prayers and sacrifices and what not have you. But they didn't bring their gods into this existential question. Well, they did, but what we know them for, what persists into our day, isn't the Olympic religion. None of us, you know, worship Zeus or Ares or Aphrodite, but philosophy, right? That is their authoring, you know, that comes up to us to this day, which gives us a different way, a secular way of trying to approach this question of how we ought to live. And something, you know, that what Socrates called the examined life, you know, and probably the most well-known soundbite in Western philosophy is that the unexamined life is not worth living, which he pronounced, according to Plato, during the trial of his life, in which he was voted guilty and then put to death by his fellow Athenians. So he was offering an answer to this question that was in some ways at odds with his society. They didn't put him to death.
And do you think that persecution of philosophy, even in ancient Greece, has anything to do with the sort of, not maybe persecution of philosophy, but maybe even just the disinterest in philosophy that we sort of feel today when we talk about it? Or do you think is there a connection there at all? I mean, a lot of, even you speak this in Plato the Googleplex, a lot of the way we shaped our society, the way our founders thought about building America was based on ideas from ancient Greece. Right? When you go to Washington, D.C., it looks like, absolutely, many of the buildings look like ancient Greek temples, right? So do you think that persists at all?
Absolutely. You know, I live here in Boston, which I think in the 19th century had dubbed itself the Athens of America, you know, so there's both a respect for it. And you're absolutely right. You know, Plato had grave reservations about democracy. It was the democracy that put Socrates to death. He was voted to death by his fellow citizens. And so our founders studied Plato. I mean, to be educated in those days meant to read the classics. So they all knew their Plato, but they formed this democracy with Plato's criticisms in mind. You know, so there were checks on mob rule, checks and balances, and you know, the Electoral College and all sorts of ways that they devised this so that they could control what Plato had seen as the dangers inherent in democracy. How well they did in constructing our institutions are being put to the test right now. Plato, of course, saw the greatest threat to democracy as the silver-tongued demagogue. You know, who would work on people's emotions and resentments, resentments against the elites, and so you know we're watching not just in the United States but all over the world in Europe, you know, in the rise of populist autocracy. Why aren't people like sort of aware of this? You know why? So that's a really interesting question because, you know, part of what I was saying is, you know, my motivation that people should know something about this amazing field that addresses questions that really relate to them. Not all of them, like, you know, I'm terrifically interested in philosophy of mathematics and I wrote a book on Gödel's incompleteness theorem. I don't expect everybody to be interested in that, right? But the sorts of general questions, epistemology, ethics, political philosophy, philosophy of religion, these are things that do concern everybody. They just don't know that it concerns them. So why is there this sort of, dismissal of professional philosophers? Partly it might be the fault of philosophers themselves who are only interested in talking to each other and, you know, haven't put themselves out in the public the way certain scientists have, for example, who often get criticized for doing that because they wander into philosophical terrain, and then the philosophers are saying, oh, Richard Dawkins, you know, I mean, he doesn't understand philosophy. Why is he wandering into this terrain? Well, then you do it, and philosophers should be doing it. But, you know, partly it's the profession that is not terribly interested in addressing the public at large, but it's also something that Plato himself, I mean, he's incredibly clever, this guy. He had seen at the very dawn of philosophy in his dialogue with the Protagoras, which, by the way, he wrote for the population. He wrote all of these dialogues for the population at large. This is not what they were talking about in the academy that he founded. This was really for the public. But in the Protagoras, he has Socrates saying this amazing thing, which is that Socrates is talking there about the resentment that people have for philosophers. And he says, look, if there's somebody who thinks he plays the flute terrifically well, he thinks he's very talented in the flute, and he really sucks, you know, and he's tooting away on the corner, and his relatives and his friends are going to say, stop it. You're embarrassing yourself. You can't play the flute. And maybe he'll be miffed, but he'll get over it. He'll find something else to do, right? If you say to somebody, look, you think you know the difference between truth and falsehood. You think that your beliefs are justified. You think your actions are justified. You can't do this stuff. This is philosophy. There are people who are talented in this and who have been trained in this, and they can do it. In some sense, you're imputing his humanity. I mean, what's he going to do? Stop believing? Stop acting? Stop trying to justify his beliefs and actions? He won't be human anymore. So there's something, because it is so deeply human, philosophy, it incites a kind of resentment when somebody says, oh, I'm trained in this. I can do it. Listen to me. Learn from me. And that is also, I think, partly the problem here. So my way of doing it is to try to just enfold it into writing that will somehow, what Plato did. I mean, he wrote these beautiful dialogues. I mean, I shouldn't compare myself. I mean, he wrote really amazing, beautiful works of art. And but the philosophy is enfolded in it. And they're dramatic. There are even some historians who say that the dialogues were written to not only for the, you know, people outside the academy, but they were actually performed as theater pieces, as philosophical drama in the academy, which is just a lovely, lovely thought.
It's beautiful. And I mean, and I think you do that idea of enfolding philosophy. I mean, that's something you do incredibly well, I thought, in your book, Plato with the Googleplex. And one thing that's interesting about that book and relates to what we're talking about, the subtitle is Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. And I feel like you can interpret that, or at least I did, in like an optimistic and a pessimistic way, right? Like, right? So, I mean, optimistically, right, it won't go away because it's core and it's foundational to sort of all these issues that we're even talking about today, like populism and what it means to believe something. But, I mean, pessimistically, is that because there aren't good answers to these questions? And so I'd like you to talk a little about that and how you think about progress in philosophy, which I know is something that you do think a lot about.
Yeah, I do. And I do think that, you know, there's, because it's not empirical, you know, it's not like, you know, there's something in the lab or, you know, in the observatory that we can see that's going to decide between, oh, is mathematics a description of reality or is it a higher form of chess, you know? You know, we don't get these definitive answers. We do often find out that there are certain inconsistencies in our views. I mean, that's, you know, it's not an accident that Plato has Socrates employing the reductio ad absurdum so often. You know, what he would do would be elicit various opinions from people, you know, all of which, you know, they believe A, B, and C, and then deduce a contradiction and then say, look, something's wrong here. And I think that that's part of what, you know, philosophy does, and that it shows us that there are certain commitments that we make that we can't live our lives without making them, and that but then So we're, you know, certain commitments, but then there are other things that we believe or that our actions imply that we believe that are inconsistent with what we've already committed ourselves to. And, you know, we are able to inhabit our inconsistencies very well. We're very compartmentalized. I think it's part of philosophy's job to destroy that happy coexistence with our inconsistencies. And so that's mm-hmm. part of the way I think that philosophy, and I think in ethics that has been particularly, particularly relevant to the progress that we've made in, you know, recognizing recognizing as if they don't even need justifications, the certain rights that we have, that people of our own kind have, you know, that our whole emotional makeup is implicated in our feeling, you know, that we have certain rights and our outrage and indignation when those are violated. And then, but up violating other people's rights, you know, especially if they belong to a different group and all of this. And that's, you know, that's partly our evolution stepping in. You know, we have a certain tribalism and xenophobia just built into us. But, you know, what philosophical arguments have often done is gone after, you know, shown the inconsistency in this, you know, and if you have the right to demand certain rights, right? What is it about you that's so very special, right? And can it not be applied, you know, to people of different classes? Can it not be applied to people of different ethnicities, different religions, different genders, different sexual choices? All of these, to children, all of these were progressive movements that began in arguments, showing that there was no way to defend, you know, just hugging these rights to oneself, the people who had them, and not, you know, universalizing them. And so there, this is, it works by way of trying to show that, you know, that there are inconsistencies here. And I think that's one of the ways that we make progress in philosophy. But you're right. You know, I also understood that that subtitle, why philosophy won't go away, is just, oh God, well, you know, it's just enough. Will we never get the definitive answers to these, but also very hopeful. Because what it means is we're always open to new ways of looking and to new questions. And, you know, I'm particularly, since I came from the sciences, I hang out with scientists, that's my orientation. I'm particularly interested in the kinds of philosophical questions that are thrown off by science as it makes progress, you know. So AI now, for example, or the progress we've made in neuroscience, you know. So it throws off its own philosophical questions that can't be answered by those techniques
within that domain,
but require the philosophical.
Right. I mean, that's one of my favorite scenes in Play with the Googleplex is at the end, he's getting a brain scan by a neurosurgeon in a lab. And he has this really amazing discussion about these philosophical ideas with the new knowledge that he's acquired about the way the brain is structured. I mean, and I think your two examples right there were perfect. You know, two fields that are moving incredibly quickly today in science are obviously like what we know about the brain and what we can do with artificial intelligence. And so do you think that those fields are opening up new questions for us to answer? Are they throwing off new questions, or are they pointing us back towards these same questions we've still been wrestling with? Or is it some combination of the two?
Yeah, probably some combination of the two. You know, I myself think, for the progress that we've made in neuroscience, for example, rules out certain philosophical positions. I think it's hard to be a mind-body dualist in the light of what we know about the brain. You know, it was possible for Descartes, it was possible, you know, until quite recently. But I mean, as we've made such progress in neuroscience, mapping exactly where, you know, these various aspects of consciousness take place, it just becomes extremely improbable. I mean, it's still a possibility, you know, there could be a one-to-one correspondence between the soul and, you know, what takes place in your amygdala and your frontal lobes and all of that, but it's just very unlikely. So, you know, so I think, you know, sometimes we make progress with the false, we don't get the definitive answer, but the attribution of probabilities shifts because of what we learned scientifically. It's not exactly the same problem that we've been considering all through, you know, since Descartes. But it's not yet, you know, completely answered. It could be. Someday we could get the reduction, you know, so that, you know, my husband gets put into a brain scan and I discover all of these deep, I'm looking at it, I know how to read it, I discover all these secrets about him or something. Or discover even more pertinently, how does he taste chocolate? Because he does not like chocolate, he hates chocolate. And I just think, well, he can't possibly taste it the way I do because it's just delicious, you know, it's just wonderful. So, you know, maybe he tastes it like I taste black licorice, which I don't like. So, you know, or, you know, does he see blue the way I see yellow? You know, all of these old problems, or the zombie problem, right? You know, you put somebody in and you see, oh my gosh, they have no inner life, right? They are only acting as if they have an inner life. You know, we could get to that point. We're not at that point yet. So this question still remains open. But, you know, some people would say, and I think this is really important, you know, that some of the things we've learned about neuroscience not only makes dualism improbable, it rules out the possibility of moral agency, of, you know, any sense of accountability or moral responsibility that we have. And these are things that philosophers have to look at very, very carefully. I actually don't think the argument goes through, but it's very tricky. Yeah, so the more, you know, the more scientific results we get, the more there are for philosophers to think about. I mean, something that's really interesting is in philosophy of physics. When I was studying physics, you know, quantum mechanics, very weird theory, very, very weird, very bizarre. And there was only one answer that you would get. And I know, because I would ask my professors, is, you know, like, what kind of reality is this that's being described here? You're not allowed to ask that question. That's not a question. Shut up and calculate, which is, I think, what Richard Feynman had put it. And, you know, there was a kind of Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which was, you know, basically nothing exists until it's measured. You know, so this very sort of positivistic answer. And a lot of philosophers of science, you know, sort of rejected this and, you know, said, you know, it was positivistic and, you know, that this is not the only possibility. Einstein certainly rejected it, but other philosophers in the Einsteinian spirit did. And now we have a plurality of interpretations. You know, there's the multiverse, there's Bohmian mechanics. And it was partly because, you know, sort of philosophers got into the act as well as philosophically minded scientists and realized the questions they were asking were philosophical, you know, and so the physicists can all agree on how you do what quantum mechanics is telling us we ought to observe, and, you know, they can shut up and calculate. But in terms of what kind of reality is this, there can be different opinions, and because those are philosophical questions. So it's a way in which the philosophical questions, as often has happened in the history of philosophy, has sort of contributed to the scientific progress, and by pushing scientists to think in certain directions. that often happens.
Yeah. It seems like you get a lot of this technological progress, then at some point you hit a philosophical wall and you could have to look back and say, hey, you know, what do we think about this? Is this right or wrong? I mean, you see that at some point, even today, I think this is moving a little bit outside of science, but when people talk about, like, you know, like fake news and whether or not we can trust experts, we've gotten to this point where we've democratized information and the ability to sort of like know things and evaluate your own sources. And now people are saying, you know, how do we know what's real? You know, what's true, what's not? Do you think Plato or philosophy has anything to say about that?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I actually had written an article. I had been asked to write this article for the Wall Street Journal on, you know, post-truth. Like, what does a philosopher have to say about post-truth? And I got a tremendous amount of response to it. Mostly positive, not all positive. But, you know, what's we see here, you know, it's often social media is blamed. And I don't think that, or you know, the you know, just online life, you know, has been blamed. And it's true that this disseminates and exacerbates what's going on, but I don't think it's really the source of the problem. The real source of the problem is the tribalizing truth. I mean, that you believe something because the group that you identify with, the group that really gives you your sense of identity, believes this. And, you know, it's part of the slogan of the group. So, you know, if I know somebody's views on, I don't know, if I know who they voted for in 2016, I might know something about, do they think climate change is man-made or not, right? Because, you know, it's become politicized. So things that have independent truth values and that even there's evidence for which truth value it has, these very, like, climate change, right? Or, you know, is genetically engineered food bad for us, or do vaccinations cause autism? You know, that there is tremendous amount of evidence here, but if you belong to certain groups, you get that evidence is not only irrelevant, the very fact that there's so much counter evidence for what you believe shows how loyal to your group you are. You know, because 98 or 97% of climate scientists believe that global warming is man-made. And if I don't believe in it, that just shows what a loyal, you know, trooper I am. And that's what's happened with so many issues that are terrifically important to our future, the future of the planet, all of, you know, become politicized. So that's an interesting. And of course, it can't be truth if you think about it. You know, truth, it's in our interest to know the truth. Bernard Williams has this wonderful book. If you haven't read it, I really recommend it, called Truth and Truthfulness. It sort of argues for, you know, it is really in our interest. We can't know everything by ourselves. We have to pool our information. I'm in a good position to know this. You're in a good position to know that. We have to pool our information, and we have to be able to trust each other. You know, we have to be sincere. Otherwise, what we have to say to each other is not going to be useful. So it's just built into the foundations of, you know, what it is to be human. I mean, we're a gregarious species, and we have to rely on each other. Truth, without a commitment to the truth, we're pretty much doomed. And that is one of the things that's happening now. So, yeah, philosophers can really talk to this. I mean, Bernard Williams, if he were with us still, would have much to say about this.
I was going to ask that if there's some, you know, maybe some technologists who are listening to this podcast, or even people who are interested in philosophy. We've talked a lot about Plato, but I'm interested in, you know, you mentioned Bernard Williams. What other philosophers would you recommend people who maybe are interested in learning more, some books or places to go where they can sort of dive more into this field? I mean, I would recommend your own books, But other than that, where else would you recommend people sort of jump in?
Depends what they're interested in. So, it's not a completely disinterested recommendation, sure. But, I actually think the book of Steven Pinker, to whom I happen to be married, that was just published, Enlightenment Now, it's a very good argument for how, commitment to reason, science, and philosophical reasoning has just really helped us make progress, cumulative progress. And this isn't an argument that things are necessarily going to get better, quite the contrary. But it is an argument that there's a lot to lose if we take for granted, this commitment to scientific and philosophical reasoning. So books that have really influenced me, everything by Bernard Williams, okay. I would recommend, The Sense of the Past, Truth and Truthfulness. My dissertation advisor, was Thomas Nagel, and he's written some amazing books. I love his book in moral philosophy called The Possibility of Altruism. But he has a book that's very good for people just beginning, and I can't quite, it's something like The Big Questions or something like that. But it's a thin little book that, sort of goes through all these various big philosophical questions, free will and ethics and the status of the a priori. Another book I really love is The Problems of Philosophy by, this is what sleep, I just got back from India, sleep deprivation.
It's okay, I can also read them. Is it?
Ian Mick, I can't believe I've forgotten his name, but names just go when I'm sleep deprived. What else off the top of my head? A Theory of Justice by Rawls, classic work.
Those are all great.
This would all be start.
Yeah, those are fantastic.
This would all be a start, and they're all readable. Mm-hmm. They're highly readable.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, and I'll link those all below. Yeah, okay, well, I think that's everything. Well, thank you so much for your time. This was really fantastic.
Oh, my pleasure. And if I think of some more books, I'll just email them to you. I'm always sort of at a loss when people think of books, but there are a host of them.